For those of us who have lived in this area for a long time, it's difficult to believe, but it has been 3 decades since Hollywood took over the Capital Region for the filming of the movie Ironweed. Adapted for the screen by William Kennedy from his Pulitzer Prize-winning novel, Ironweed tells the tale of Francis Phelan, a drifter who returns to his home city of Albany to make peace with a past that haunts him.
So you want to be buried under a stone like that?
I never knew no bum buried under a gravestone.
I don't need me no stone. This soldier don't have to die alone.
You die first, I'll send out the invites.
Filmed at several Albany locations, it brought international attention to the Capital Region and earned Oscar nominations for both Jack Nicholson and Meryl Streep. There will be a 30th anniversary screening of the film this Friday night, 7 o'clock at Page Hall on the downtown campus. At 6:30, there will be a conversation with William Kennedy and Marion Roach talking about the film and about the filming here in Albany. It's a great pleasure to welcome the screenwriter for the film and the author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel, William Kennedy. Thank you very much for being with us. What a delight to have you here.
Okay, Joe. Nice to look at Ironweed on the big screen again. It's going to be.
Yeah. It's very, very nice to think of that and to celebrate 30 years. Let's go back and have you tell us what it was like to see it the first time on the big screen. You obviously played a hand. You were there much of the time during the filming. But when you sat down and you saw it on the big screen for the first time, what was that experience for you like?
The first time was actually when I saw it was in Hollywood. And I was out there to talk with Hector Bibenco, the director, and we were going over scenes that could be cut. The big problem was cutting, you know. It was 2 hours and 45 minutes, and it got down to 2 hours and 20 minutes. I've forgotten all the cuts, but I think it went down to 2 hours and 12 minutes. And Hector said, we wondered if I would need an ambulance at the screening because of the cuts that they had made when I was not there. But I was pained. Yeah, it was painful. But I did chime in and make some suggestions and also did some rewriting, actually, on a couple of scenes to cut down the dialogue and was able to edit it in a way to save the scene. And I got about, I don't know, a minute out of one scene and 2 minutes out of another scene. Mm-hmm. And whatever it was, we got it down to the 2 hours and 12. And that's the way it's on the screen now. And it was a very strong movie. Jack Nicholson was there when we screened it for the final version there. And he had really done a version himself, actually. And he cut quite a few things, and Hector Bibenco came back. He was in Brazil at the time, and then he came back, and he cut it again. And then we went in and did the final cut. And Jack still thought it was a little too long. Well, I don't think it was. I mean, maybe a little bit here and there. There's always something that's cuttable, but it's a strong movie, and I loved it. I just think those performances by Rudy, you know, Tom Waits and
right.
Jack and Merrill and, you know, so many others.
I just saw the film last week again and reminded of what an incredible cast, but Nathan Lane.
That was one of Nathan Lane's early movies. He gets killed in it, of course. And
yeah.
He plays the scab motorman and Francis throws the stone and during the strike and the trolley strike and in 1901 when he's a 17, 16-year-old boy or whatever it is, 13, 14.
Makes 80, ghostly appearances in the film.
Right, and he comes back.
You write the novel. The novel wins the Pulitzer Prize. At what point do you start hearing that Hollywood is interested in making a film?
Well, I didn't expect it. I had written two other novels. My first novel in the Albany cycle was Legs in 1975, and that one under option immediately. And and then my next novel was Billy Phelan's Greatest Game, and that was in 1978. A few years after that, that was under option. It was in 83, I think, 5 years later. But nobody was thinking about Ironweed when it first came out. I mean, it's Bums in Albany. And it wasn't expected to be an unacceptable kind of subject matter or, for a million reasons. But Hector Babenco got very interested in it. He was looking for, he actually was in Hollywood, and somebody said, you should get a hold of a copy of Legs and see Kennedy's book. And he said, that's going to be a good movie. He went out looking for a copy of Legs, and he couldn't find it, but he found a copy of Ironweed. So he got on a plane and went back to Brazil, and he read the book over a weekend, or was on the beach or something, and he got started on the book, and he got stuck in it. You know, he got really he loved it, and he read it all the way through, like in a day or 2 days or something like that. And it was his first book that he had ever read all the way through in English, because he was a Spanish speaker who became a Portuguese speaker. He lived in Brazil until this year. He died last. We were going to have him come up, maybe be around for this screening, but alas, Hector is gone. Anyway, he came back to the States with this book full in his mind and went to the producers, and they wouldn't give him the time of day. He'd had a couple of good movies out, two good movies in Brazil, and then another one that was screened in Cannes and won some sort of a prize, Pixote. And he was known in this country for Pixote, but not very well known, you know, a foreign director and Portuguese language and so. But anyway, I had seen it and I liked it. And eventually, because he couldn't get anywhere with the producers, my agent said to him, why don't you call Kennedy? And so he did. And I was going to be in New York, and I got together with him, and we spent 3 hours conversing about this and that. And then he said, look, I'm going to show my new movie, which is Kiss of the Spider Woman. And he said, I'm going to show it tomorrow afternoon, and do you want to come and see it? And I said, great. So I went to see it, and then we went to lunch afterward. And I said, this is a fantastic movie. I would love to see you direct my movie, because this has got the level of imagination and spiritual imagination and surreal dreamlike elements. And it's also got the nitty-gritty of the real world. And so I called Hollywood and talked to the producers, talked to my agent, and they called the producer. And finally the producer said, all right, if he wants to do it, let's do it. Let's do it. So I shook hands with Hector, and we had a deal.
Did you feel better that you were the screenwriter? I mean, so many times the author hands it off to somebody else. The fact that you got to write this character and these characters that of course you were so tied to, continued to be tied to, was that good for you?
It was, and I loved doing it. And in those days, that was the way I wanted it to happen. I had let Legs be optioned and I didn't have any real connection to doing any screenwriting myself at that point. I was a movie critic, but that didn't mean I knew anything about screenwriting. But after a while, I did know about screenwriting. I started to teach myself in the late 70s, and by this time, I felt... Well, by 1983, I got to work with Francis Coppola, and I wrote The Cotton Club. And I had written a screenplay of my own that I had just invented, and I was constantly learning, you know. So I said, I want to do it. And that was the way we sold it. I sold all the rights, but I'm going to write the screenplay. And it was an independent production anyway, so, you know, you don't have to fight the studio system, which... puts the writer last, you know.
And this to me says a lot, because we could have said this 30 years ago, we could say it today, and it still holds true, but you get the two biggest movie stars in all of film.
Right, that was unbelievable. Hector had been in Hollywood, and he had met Jack, and they got along very well. And I think Jack liked the movie. I guess he liked The Kiss of the Spider Woman. Who didn't? It was a terrific movie. Well, that was our first choice. I mean, we'd been thinking about Gene Hackman. Paul Newman wanted to do it, but I didn't know it until after Jack had gotten the part. Anyway, there were a lot of other candidates available, but Jack was number one. And Hector said, look, when we get the script together, we worked on it for 12 days, and we put together a script. Maybe it was a little more than that, I don't know, but not a whole lot much more. Maybe 12 days was the first blast, and maybe we came back and did it a couple more days. And then Hector flew from Albany to L.A., and the first thing he did was take it out to see Jack and gave him the script. And he read the script, and he said, I like it, I'll do it. He had already read the book. So we had Jack. And then about 3 days later, I got a call from an agent, Hollywood agent from New York, and he said to me, I knew him, he was in my old agency, and he said, Merrill has expressed an interest in this movie, and I wonder, could you send me a script? And I sent him down a script, and about 3 days later, or 2 days later, I got a call and Merrill was going to do it. So we had Merrill and Jack, two of the biggest names in show business, and then we did not have a producer at that point. Mm-hmm. And we had been fishing around for a while, but nobody was really biting. But when these two came along, then there was a woman named Marcia Nassiter who was behind it from the beginning. She was there the night that when Hector's movie appeared in was the night that we saw it in New York together, Hector and I, and then we had dinner at Marcia's house, and she was going to be the producer of this. And at 11 o'clock, we sent out for the reviews to get the Times and the Daily News, whatever was going to come with all the reviews, and they were all rave reviews of Kiss of the Spider Woman. And the next day, around the block lines to get into the movie, and Hector got a lot of calls to do other movies, but he was convinced on Ironwood. So that's how we went. And then Marcia was, you know, part and parcel of the whole operation.
The other coup, I would think, for you and for the film, is that you got to shoot it in Albany.
Right.
You weren't in a back lot somewhere in Hollywood.
No. I always was pushing for Albany, you know. And the Hollywood people, when they finally came into it, Keith Barish, who had produced Sophie's Choice, the William Styron novel. And he was looking for another literary book, and he found Ironweight. And he came up, he had a contract with the Taft Broadcasting Company. The company was called Taft Barish, and they became the producers. They were worried about Albany and the weather, you know, the snow, this takes place in Halloween, and the 1st of November and the 2nd of November, 3 days there, and that's when the story of the movie takes place. Mm-hmm. In the novel. And, you know, they were, how are we going to do? We'll shovel snow up to our noses when, no, so they sent, we didn't have any snow to speak of that year. For some reason or other, it was a mild January, and we restarted in February. We actually started in the previous August and working on location scouting and all that. And they sent the production designer, Janine Opawal, down to, I think it was South Carolina or North Carolina, one of the Carolinas, to see whether they could have an Albany from down there. And they decided, after she decided that Albany in Albany looked more like Albany in North Carolina.
So, funny how that works. Yes. William Kennedy is our guest. There will be a 30th anniversary screening of Ironweed tomorrow night at 7 o'clock at Page Hall on the downtown campus of UAlbany. You can visit the New York State Writers Institute online for more information. When you look at it, I mean, it it's what you, I assume, saw in your mind as you were telling the story, because it is Albany, and it so beautifully reflects the city at that time. And of course, anyone who watches the film now certainly sees many, many things that are incredibly familiar to them.
Yeah, well, the settings were very realistic. We found the mission in Troy. South Pearl Street wasn't where it used to be. A lot of it had been knocked down by the mall and the Rockefeller building, the South Mall. And there wasn't a lot of downtown was gone. But Troy and River Street and 3rd and 2nd Street, 1st Street, there still had some places that looked really good, and were able to set up what we used for Broadway, South Pearl Street, whatever it was, the south end of Albany. And it really looked like it in the old days. And then, of course, they used St. Joseph's Church, where that was the parish in which Francis Phelan's family lived, and that was very apt to use that. I had it at St. Anthony's Church in a novel, but that was long since closed down. And we had a lot of wonderful locations. And Slingerland's, we found an old house to use for Katrina's house, mm-hmm. and up in Cahoe's, and I think we got the meat market up there, and where Francis buys the turkey when he goes home to see Annie and his kids. Anyway, it's, it is real Albany streets, and I remember saying something like, this is of Albany, by Albanians, about Albanians, and shot in Albany, when we got to the premiere at the Palace Theater, which was a great night.
Great night.
2,500 people or so.
One of the filming locations was Restaurant Paradiso, was on Central Avenue in Albany. And that, of course, is where Meryl Streep sings in the bar. And it's just a great scene.
I would like to sing this for my man, Francis. I know a lad, and when I feel bad, he scares all my troubles away. When he's your friend, he's yours till the end, no matter what others may say.
That's my favorite scene in the movie. It's, I was in it, but that's not why it's my favorite scene. But we were in it, my wife and I were in it, and we were dressed up like swells in the 30s. I got a double-breasted suit and a very tight haircut and rimless spectacles and a pocket handkerchief, and Dana's got a Marcel hairdo, and she looks great. And so we were the swells sitting alongside the bums in this mm-hmm. new cafe, and it's supposed to be down in Green Street. That was my wife chose that scene. She said, that's one I want to be, because they'll never cut that scene. I remember Tommy Whelan, the mayor, was in a scene in the Troy Library, and where Helen has a fit, and she goes into a monologue. It's brilliant by Meryl, where she talks about her brother and the way they stole her fortune and so on.
Are you staying with your brother while you're here?
Well, I suppose we're very close.
I saw him in church only last week.
In church?
Mm-hmm.
Imagine that.
I go past his home all the time. It's
hypocrite.
So...
What's he doing in church after what he did to me?
What?
Well, you know, he and my mother, they stole all the money my father left me.
No.
Oh, yes, that's right. For 15 years, you see, they hid the will.
Oh, I'm so
11 of those years I knew.
I'm sorry, but you'll have to leave.
Sorry. You're sorry for me.
But you're making
I
much too much.
I
much
wanted to be free. Much. Even if it had, I had to suffer for it. All right. I got even. I left her with the peacock there. Thieves, they were.
And then a lot of that scene got cut, and Tommy wound up on the cutting room floor, alas. But that's the fate of a lot of actors. But that scene in the Paradiso, what became the Paradiso, they wanted to call the old Boulevard Cafeteria where I grew up. I spent days and days and days in that place. I mean, I grew up there. Anyway, it was a great event, and there was 18 takes, and then it was in the 18th take of Helen singing. Babenco came out and said, "We're going to do one more take for Meryl," and that was the one. And when she started to sing, it just came to life in a different way. You know, I could just sense it. You know, I said, "This is him. She's doing something different. I don't know what." And then she came down, and she wound up coming past our table, and she always stopped at our table, she said, to give the writer a little screen time. Mm-hmm. And so the camera would stop and focus on us at the table. But this time she stopped, and she leaned over and she kissed me.
He'd do the same thing for me. He'll always be there, stormy weather or fair.
And then she went on, and then she hit this high note at the end, which was, I mean, she always hit the high note, but this time she hit it, and it was so clear, and it was so strong. And then Hector, when he said, "Cut," and then he let out a whoop, and it was just, you knew that that was the great take, and we saw it, you know, later that day, or maybe it was the next day, I don't remember, when we saw the dailies.
He's the best, and I love him. He's me pearl, he's me pearl.
It was a stunning performance. I remember Jack said, "Yeah, Meryl rocked him." And she did, she did. It was a great scene.
We're talking to William Kennedy about the 30th anniversary screening of the film Ironweed, which takes place Friday night, this Friday night, December 9th, at Page Hall, 135 Western Avenue on the UAlbany downtown campus. The screening of the film is at 7 o'clock, but at 6:30, William Kennedy will be speaking with Marion Roach about the making of the film, and also on display will be photos from the filming in downtown Albany.
Right, there's going to be a loop, I think, of films, of old photos and pictures of the headlines and the great coverage that we got on it. The Times Union wrote two stories a day on the making of the film every day. And the Troy Record cover, the Schenectady Gazette, the Hudson Register Star, and so on. You know, so many, all the local papers got into the act. It was a huge thing. I mean, they made millions of dollars for the area. Millions and millions of dollars came into this town. I had a number based on the governor's, when we were talking about the budget of the film being $18 million, I think it was more than that. I think it was in the 20s.
Yeah, I've seen 23 as the 23.
Yeah. And on the basis of $18 million, they multiply by 2.3 in order to figure out what will bring it into for a 3-month shoot. And they got to the point where $40 million would come into Albany. And so if that was $18 million, I would multiply 2.3 by 2.3 by 23, and you get a lot more. I don't know how much you get, but it's
a big influx into the region.
Yeah, it's an enormous thing. I mean, there's so many people on the crew working and people coming in to watch the shooting and all the actors and then just... the traffic and what they buy and what they rent, all the rentals from everybody who's living here. You know, they have to have a hotel room someplace, and the food restaurants did a great business downtown, and all over Wolf Road, Troy. Anyway, it was a spectacular event in almost every way. And then we had a premiere, you know, at the Palace, and we made an enormous amount of money. I mean, we sold...
This was in December of 1987 then, right?
Yes, right. I mean, we had 2,500 people coming in at $125 a pop, and we gave away $170,000 worth of shelter, food, and counseling. We gave away to a lot of the homeless agencies, and, mm-hmm. and the Capital City Rescue Mission got some money. The DePaul residents, the Next Step Incorporated, St. Charles Lwanga Center and Unity House. And this was all distributed out of City Hall in Albany through the mayor's office. And also, one of the things that we did was to put aside, I think, about $25,000 for the Writers Institute, which I had founded. But this was specifically to start a classic film series, which we were doing marginally, but we needed the big space at Page Hall, which is where we're going to show the movie on Friday.
Friday night. And of course, this is part of that series that has been around.
That's been around ever since. You know.
William Kennedy is our guest this morning. We're talking about the 30th anniversary screening of Ironweed, which takes place tomorrow night, December 9th, at 7 o'clock at Page Hall on Western Avenue on the downtown campus of UAlbany. There will also be a conversation at 6:30 with William Kennedy and Marion Roach. You can find out about it all by going to the New York State Writers Institute online. We'll continue our conversation with William Kennedy after this short break. Welcome back to the Roundtable. We're talking about the 30th anniversary screening of the film Ironweed, taking place tomorrow night at Page Hall on Western Avenue in the downtown campus of UAlbany.
Look at you. New suit. Look at me. I look like a damn bum.
You are a bum.
You know why people call you a bum? Because it makes them feel better when they say it.
Well, the truth can't hurt you. You're a bum.
Oh, God, Freddy. There must be a God that protects some bums. Well, look at me. Freddy, I'm gonna kill myself.
You ain't intelligent enough to kill yourself.
Filmed at several Albany locations, Ironweed brought international attention to the Capital Region and earned Oscar nominations for both Jack Nicholson and Meryl Streep. And we continue our conversation with Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist William Kennedy. Let's talk about the novel for a moment. As you mentioned earlier, this is the third novel that you had written. And when you started out with Legs, was it always your intention for this to be a trilogy or to be a cycle? Was it something that you saw these characters living on past that one book?
No, it wasn't. It wasn't intentional. When I was writing Legs, it took me 6 years, and I spent like 2 years on research alone in libraries in New York and the newspaper morgues and every place. And I came across people in Legs Diamond's life who I knew were also going to be, or who had been, significant in the famous kidnapping of Dan O'Connell's nephew in 1933. It was Johnny O'Connell, who's the son of Dan's brother, John, Solly, and they held him for ransom for $40,000. That's what they finally paid. They wanted $250,000. But that was a very, very famous case, and I knew about it. I'd grown up with all the legends of it, and I realized that I wanted to write that after I finished with Legs. And I put it in a political year to 1938 to make it, because I wanted to have the politics of the kidnapping be part of the story. So I then had two novels. And when I wrote Billy Phelan's Greatest Game, which was the second book, that was the story of the kidnapping. In Billy Phelan, I have Billy's father, Francis, on the page for not the first time, because I had written a book earlier that was never published, and it was called The Angels and the Sparrows, and I had created Francis Phelan in there. And I reached back to that old novel and pulled him out and put him into Billy Phelan. And he became such an interesting character when I transformed him in Billy that I realized that he had his own novel. I could do a whole novel on him. Mm-hmm. And so that's what I did. And then that's what became Ironweed. And so that became my third book. And I had another book out of it called The Flaming Corsage, which I started to write first. And I couldn't finish it because I didn't know enough about the period. I didn't know enough about playwriting and the history of the bourgeois Irish at the turn of the century and the theater at the turn of the century. And so I had to do a lot more research before I could write that book. But I did eventually write it and came out in 96. But there was never any intention to either call this a trilogy. By the time the trilogy was published in 83, you know, Ironweed was published in January, and they republished Legs and Billy Phelan, which were both out of print at that time. And so it looked like I had really arrived with three books in hand, and then everybody called it a trilogy. And yeah. So it stayed that way it's still that way. A lot of people never thought there was anything else, but I've written, you know, like eight books now, nine books in the trilogy, and the cycle was what I thought about as a word. O'Neill had used that in a cycle of plays that he was writing about the American experience, and that word just seemed to fit what I was doing. It was going back in time into historical recreations and following two or three, four families and finding these people are recycled in the novels. Every novel that you meet people from the other novels. The lives interweave and affect the future books. It was something that I had, you know, admired in William Faulkner's work. Mm-hmm. And I never thought that I would even begin to, you know, do anything like Faulkner had done. But it was in the back of my mind that I was doing it. Once I had found the interconnectedness of the people, it became a viable thing to do. It seemed like it was a given. I had like seven or eight or nine books in me that I could go on for a long time, and I did.
What was it about those people, those characters that you think resonated with us, that we were reading about people who were having very difficult, complex lives, but were still so meaningful and still so larger than life? Because perhaps on that page, they're larger than life, but in our society, they're so often brushed aside.
Well, it's a crapshoot. Nothing is written in stone that will tell you that you are going to write a serious character that will resonate with the reader. You hope for it. You try for it. You know how it's done in other books. You know how you've done it in the past books. But it's new every time out. And sometimes the characters are really, they just come to you, you know? Yeah. I remember writing one of Helen's experiences when she was dying in the room alone, and all she had with her was this little suitcase full of trinkets and earrings, and she had stolen a record from a record store, and Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, and she was had it playing in her mind, and she was alone. She was at the bottom of the world, and she's rethinking her life and talking about her relationship to herself, to Francis, and to her family and her ex-lover and her father who left her a fortune and then killed himself, and the mother took the fortune away and gave it to her brother, etc. I mean, and all of this is, she's interweaving with everything that's been happening to her today as well. And I sat there one afternoon and it just came in a rush. I knew I was onto something that was unusual. And that's a very strong section in the novel, and in the film too. It's broken up in the film, but it has some power, and it's larger than life, I suppose, if that's what you started out saying. And I saw it in my head, and I started to transcribe it, what was in my head, and it came out very fast. I think I wrote the whole scene in maybe 2-3 days, and most of it in one afternoon. Mm. And I can't tell you why it came. It was just a perfect moment, the perfect storm, you know. Everything had fallen into place. All the knowledge I had of Helen's past and the knowledge I had of what she had just gone through, and I had begun to focus on who she was and figure out, and I knew she was dying, and she didn't know why or anything, but she knew she couldn't eat. She was feeling awful. And so, you know, I'd seen a lot of people die. And I just put this all into a scene, a single scene, and there it came. You try to do that every time, of course, sure. You know, and you try to create these characters who will live on the page, and you try to make them as real and as significant as you can, and you try to have a good story so you're telling something about them that means something to somebody else. I mean, what is a lost life recapitulated? What does that mean? Well, it means a lot, and it meant a lot to me, and that's the way I thought about it. And I thought about Francis the same way, and he was a different cat. He was funny and irreverent and totally lost as Helen was, and in his own way. And then Rudy, you know, the crazy, crazy Rudy. Those three characters just walked into my life, and I greeted them.
There will be a 30th anniversary screening of Ironweed tomorrow night at Page Hall on Western Avenue in the downtown campus of UAlbany. At 6:30, there'll be a discussion between William Kennedy and Marion Roach, and then the film will be shown at 7 o'clock, all at Page Hall, and you can find out more information by going to the New York State Writers Institute online for more information. And we are lucky to have William Kennedy as our guest in studio this morning. I realize this is probably an impossible question to answer. I would think it would be anyway, but do you look at that as some of your... I'll ask it two ways, and you can choose how you want to answer it, which is, do you look at it as some of your finest writing? And the alternate question being, if not that, what are you proud of that you have accomplished as a novelist with these characters and writing about this city?
Well, I think that Ironweed has some of the best writing that I've done. I try to use the best language that was at my disposal, and when I wrote that book, I was willfully doing that, and there's an effort to have a poetic vision of the interior lives of these characters, as well as the hard line, hard rock daily life that they were living in the lowest part of the world, in the slums of Albany, and where they might freeze to death if they didn't get inside during the night, sleeping in the weeds. I had a drive to write well, but the novel is not all that. It's not all that poetic level. It's a lot of dialogue, a lot of action, and it has resonance for something that I found valuable, and it was that era of the Depression. I grew up as a Depression kid and never knew what the Depression was at the time. I mean, I didn't have a feeling for what was really going on in the country when I was living it. I did have a sense of it in the years immediately thereafter, and I do have strong memories of it, you know. hobos like Francis coming to our door and knocking, and my grandmother saying, you know, take this out to that man, and she'd make a sandwich and a cup of coffee and, with cream and sugar in the coffee, and a big mug of it, and a chicken sandwich or a ham sandwich, whatever we had in the refrigerator, and sometimes give them a quarter too. And I remember those guys. I remember seeing them. I remember drinking, and when I was a teenager, these guys who were still on the bum in downtown Albany. And then in the 60s, I wrote about them. A photographer got me interested in talking to one of these fellows on the street, and I followed him around for a couple of days, two or three days, Bernie Kohlenberg and I. He was a great photographer for the Times Union. We did a lot of stories together. That eventually just sat on my shelf, and I tried to make a book out of it as a nonfiction and journalistic work, and it never sold. And then so I just put it on a shelf, and I eventually turned that material into part of Ironweed. And that whole thing is my knowledge of the Depression, and I drew on the Hooverville in North Albany. That was a real place. I remember seeing it, the tar paper shacks, and it covered a couple of blocks of city blocks, and a lot of people living there. And all of a sudden, one day, it's gone, and I don't know what happened to it. I found out later that I remember somebody told me that they knew the cop who was a captain who burned it down on the city charging against the slum dwellers. And I don't think it was necessarily, you know, as vicious as what was portrayed in the novel, but what was portrayed in the novel was real. And it happened in other cities. And, you know, it's the way the homeless are chased away from so many places. And their home away from home is this Hooverville or its equivalent in any corner of the universe where they can pitch a tent with tar paper. And that's a life I wanted to represent. And I did in those three early books. And again, in Roscoe and in the Flaming Corsage, I mean, there's a lot of the early life of the people in my neighborhood, largely Irish, some of the old Dutch, Germans, Italians. That was the immigrant crew, Jews, a few blacks. They were all in the North End, and Poles, Hungarians, Middle Europeans, and it was the immigrant story, and it was the evolution of what a city, what a neighborhood, what a block, what a family was all about, and that was what I was trying to get down in paper in all these books.
Did the success of that book, and ultimately, I guess it gets down to the Pulitzer Prize, but can it be extrapolated, of course, to the film, that whole experience just changes your life?
Well, it did in a way, but in some ways it didn't. I had already committed to becoming a writer when I was broke, and I knew that was what I was going to do with my life. I stopped being a journalist, 15 times. I don't know how many. And one way or the other, I stayed with it because I had to. That's how I made money. And I stayed as this writer. I mean, I didn't move any place. I wrote. I was living in April Park. I was writing in the same rooms that I'm writing in today. And I mean, after a while, I got some money and was able to buy some of the things that I'd always wanted, and I could feel like I could buy a car that wasn't going to be breaking down every 65 miles. And I used to go out to work with a dime in my pocket so I could make a phone call to get some money if I needed it.
And of course, to be full circle, to still be here in Albany, I assume, is special to you.
Well, I realize that I couldn't live anywhere else that was as rich in significance to me. You know, living in New York, I would have taken up a position as an outsider, and I spent a lot of time in New York as a tourist. You know, as a kid, going to the theater and movies and shopping and whatnot, and all the places you go in New York. But why would I go to New York? I mean, where else would I go? Go to L.A.? I mean, I never. There are a lot of wonderful cities. I thought in Chicago. I'd love to have lived in Chicago and or New Orleans, maybe Boston. But I really didn't really need them. I felt that I should stay here. I wanted to stay here. I mean, I love it here, and I know everybody. You know, I know everything that I need to know, or if I don't know it, I'll find out. But and to be a writer, you can write any place, and why not Albany?
William Kennedy will be speaking to Marion Roach for commentary regarding the 30th anniversary screening of the film Ironweed. It takes place Friday night, December 9th, this Friday, at Page Hall in the downtown campus of UAlbany. The film screening is at 7 o'clock. The film commentary and the Q&A will take place at 6:30. Again, it is at Page Hall on Western Avenue, downtown campus of UAlbany. William Kennedy, it's always a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you so much for being
with us. Okay, Joe, thanks. It was a good conversation.
Have a wonderful event. Thank you. Again, you can find out more information by going to the New York State Writers Institute online. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.